Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Avaram, and today I'm going to take you with me on my personal journey through the new National Museum of African American History and Culture. Every one of us walking into the new bronze edifice on the National Mall will have our own unique experience, depending on what perspective, knowledge, experience, and memory we are bringing with us. Right now, I carry this struggle against physical and economic violence against Black people. I have this ever-evolving recognition of the horrors and terror that African Americans, particularly women, have lived with and continue to live with, and that we resist. This is where I am as I step into the elevator that takes me to the bottom level of the museum to begin this journey that I am sharing with you.
Wait, the elevator goes down. We go back in time all the way to 1400.
Okay.
Then we'll be heading out this way.
15th to the 19th centuries, the making of the Atlantic world. In the 1400s, national boundaries did not exist as they do today. African and European peoples had traded for centuries across the Mediterranean, exchanging diverse goods, cultures, and knowledge. An Atlantic world was forming that connected people and ports along the Atlantic Ocean's rim. By the 1600s, an unanticipated shift took place. The primary commodity became enslaved African people. This is their story. These are the opening words for the new African American Historical and Cultural Museum on the National Mall. It starts with an exhibit on the slave trade, and it starts at the very bottom of the museum. As you just heard the guide, the elevator, as you go down to the bottom floor, it goes back in time, and this is where the story begins. I linger at this beginning of the museum journey, turning my attention away from the text that I have read, which is accompanied by the first image, strange I think to be the first image that we see, a portrait of the fierce Queen Nzinga of the Congo wearing a European crown and cape. The text explains only that she converted to Catholicism and forged alliances to fight the Portuguese, without explaining further the complicity of the Catholic Church in slavery. I turn my attention to a fast-moving video about Africa in the 1400s and the gold kings and kingdoms like Ghana and Timbuktu, with quotes from those living at that time, including Aluda Ekiano, who wrote in 1789 his autobiography about his journey as a child aboard a slave ship from Africa to Barbados. In this video snapshot of pre-colonial Africa, there are drawings of some cities with blocks and blocks of buildings. From this start, I am thrown headlong into a display that does inform us how America, Europe, and what we think of as the modern world was built on the blood and spoils of the Atlantic slave trade. On one side, there are sections about slavery by region in the U.S., including the Chesapeake region, which would include Washington, D.C. There are names of slave ships like the British ship named the Happy Couple that enslaved 176 people and only 141 of those survived. Portugal by far had the bloodiest hands with 5.8 million African captives transported across the Atlantic to the Americas between 1441 and 1836. Wow. 1441. So the Portuguese had a nearly 80-year head start on everyone else, including the Dutch that joined the frenzy in 1619. Great Britain forced 3.3 million people across the ocean, France 1.4 million people. Some of the information cards.
Negroes are a perishable commodity. When you have an opportunity, dispose of them for gold. Humphrey Maupeace, 1730. There is no Spaniard who dares to stick his head in the hatch without becoming ill. So great is the stench, the crowding, and the misery of the place. Most arrive turned into skeletons. Alonso de Santoval, 1527.
But how else are the horrors of the Atlantic slave trade shown? The Middle Passage Room exhibit that includes a deck platform over what might be an empty hull of a ship is roped off, and there's nothing in the hulls, no would-be cargo there to consider. Unlike museums like, for example, the Great Blacks and Wax Museum in Baltimore, that does attempt to recreate at least a sense of the misery for visitors.
Many labels and signs are covered up today, and the mostly white crew of construction workers are buzzing around me. But I'm looking for the resistance. Where is the resistance? Maybe I'm missing something. I asked Mary Elliott, museum specialist, who co-curated the exhibit along with Nancy Burkhall. I heard you mention Nat Turner earlier, and of course he's in the news because of The Birth of a Nation is coming out, that movie. And you mentioned that this exhibit has his, is it his Bible?
Yes.
So tell me, because I didn't really see a lot about Nat Turner or resistance in this.
Can you tell me? Oh, no, that's big in this exhibition. Did you see the labels?
Some of them aren't here, but
I think they're covered up.
Yeah, tell me about the resistance.
So we talk about the fight for freedom from the time Africans are taken from their homes in the interior, right? And we carry that theme all the way through. Through on the Middle Passage, we talk about the rebellions all aboard the slave ship. Mm-hmm. In our section on colonial North America, we talk about becoming black in America, right? At the end of each of the regions that we talk about, we punch with the story of rebellion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in the Chesapeake, we talk about Bacon's Rebellion. In Low Country, we talk about the Stoner Rebellion. In Louisiana, we talk about the Samba Barbarian Rebellion. And in New York, we talk about, in 1741, a planned rebellion there that actually was thwarted, but we talk about that.
Yeah.
And then we carry it through. We even look at the Revolutionary War and African-American men fighting in that war as, in some instances, a form of rebellion as well. And then all the way through, we talk about the different ways people rebel, that it wasn't just physical fighting with guns or knives or any other form, but we talk about rebellion in terms of breaking tools, not working, different ways that people rebelled, right? The important part about that is the sense of resistance and resilience. The other important part about that rebellion is the idea of understanding freedom and fighting for that freedom, and in doing it, pushing the nation to understand what that freedom means.
I hear Mary, but I also hear her say that an exhibit like this inside a museum on the National Mall is conceived for the average visitor to the National Mall. And that's what this floor feels like. TV reporters are buzzing around prize museum objects, Harriet Tubman Shaw and hymnal book. And I'm straining to see Harriet Tubman's role as a freedom fighter illuminated. That's what I'm looking for. It actually appears that more space is given to blacks fighting in the Revolutionary War and Civil War. I see Nat Turner's Bible, but I don't see Nat Turner. I don't see a lot about him. I don't see the sense of resistance. In fact, the first statue I see as I walk into the next room is Thomas Jefferson, who the display points out was normal among slaveholders and that he owned his own children. More from the museum after this brief break. The new National Museum of African American History and Culture has a rich collection of objects that may not really be trying to speak to me and the issues of my concern. For example, let's go back to Thomas Jefferson owning his own children. This fact is just stated with no detail. There is one display where I see a reference to young women and girls being marketed as sex slaves. But if the word rape is used, I do not see it. I keep hearing curators say that this exhibit is the unvarnished truth. So I asked Mary Elliott about rape and the slave sex industry, which included breeding farms.
We made sure that we talked about the history of sexual violence because it's a reality that took place. One thing I want to make sure that people understand is we talked about sexual violence, and we were very thoughtful to make sure that we included the story of men actually being subject to sexual violence as well. I remember when we were in a review session, and I sat there with my colleagues, and I asked, okay, how are we with using the words that white men raped? And they said, it is the unvarnished truth. It's the truth that we talk about, that there were women who were raped by the slaveholders. It is part of our story. And it's just something that we have to tell this truth in order to wrestle with it and move forward. And it is history that we have to acknowledge.
Were there any of the challenges you had in terms of telling such what really, I think people acknowledge, is very brutal history in a museum setting? Did you have challenges in terms of any point not being able to explore something as fully as you wanted to, or being limited to by physical space and other considerations?
So it was heartbreaking to make choices about stories we were going to tell. And I want to introduce my colleague, Nancy Burkaw, who is a co-curator. This young lady asked me about our discussions on rape.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so I told her about how when we were in the proof session and we were like, should we say this? Mm-hmm. And how we all agreed that we had to say these things because it's the truth of this history, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of selecting the stories, we had to look at what are the most, how do I describe this, the stories that will really resonate with our visitors so they have a deeper understanding of the themes and what we're trying to tell them in this space. So, for example, domestic slave trade law, we have many bills of sales. We have lots of broadsides. But what are the ones that when we open, people will really go, I really understand this, cotton down on one end, rice field Negroes down on the other, mm-hmm. a share seizure sale, the sale of a fancy girl, right? And so we had to choose out of the broadsides, which are the ones that we really need people to look at and understand why this one is different from that one and how it is important historically.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people come to the opening, they'll see more than we can see now, so it's not really apparent that those distinctions.
Right? Yeah. The unvarnished truth is in the labels that have been intensively researched and gone through with a fine-tooth comb with a scholarly advisors. The unvarnished truth is told in dynamic ways through the design, so we really encourage you all to walk through the exhibition and really take into account some of the design features that really drive home this story.
Pay attention to what's written on the walls. And the other unvarnished truth is that it was really important to us to always use voices from the time period so that throughout you can actually hear the human voices. That the story of slavery has been told before, but it tends to be told as an economic story or as some other sort of story. This is a human story. This is an American story. So we put those voices forward so that people can feel and hear from those who lived through enslavement and manifested freedom.
Yeah.
So one thing I don't think we've really played up enough is that American freedom, many of the constitutional amendments that we rely on today grew out of the African-American community. We would not have the 14th Amendment without the actions of people who had formerly been enslaved. And that these actions don't just come out of nowhere. It was literally 80 years of people building the black abolitionist movement and enslaved people on plantations building this separate political ideology, really saying that people are created equal.
Yeah, and we start this exhibition with freedom. We start it with the story of Africa. As you see that film, when you come off, we humanize the story of Africans even before they get to the New World, right? But one thing we want to draw to your attention, as you go down the hall, you'll see we have Africa and Europe on either side. We start here. We tell the story of enslaving an African, what that human experience was like, that human cost was like. And on this other side, we really punch with the moral question. And so throughout, you'll see quite a few juxtapositions of profit and power and the human cost. You'll see the juxtaposition of the inhumanity and holding on to one's humanity. So really, we want people to pick that up as you go through. This is not told in the standard fare way. We really wanted people to wrestle with some of these ideas.
On that.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's really important is that slavery is foundational to the modern world. That the world we live in today is really built on this bedrock of slavery, and that's true for Europe as well as for the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing we want to know, and that this is, or share, and that this is a shared story. It's American story. That African Americans built our country through knowledge, through skills, through cultural expressions, through political acts.
Mm-hmm.
So we really want people to understand that, the fullness of a life.
The section on Jim Crow segregation highlights the conditions faced by men and women living under basically a system of totalitarianism. One display highlights the story of Harry and Harriet Moore, who stood for equal pay for black school teachers and were killed by the Ku Klux Klan that bombed their home on Christmas Day in 1951. And actually a shout out to the descendants of the Moors who are actually living right here in the DMV. There's another panel with the story of the rape of a woman named Gertrude Perkins, and she was attacked by two white police officers in Montgomery, Alabama. You know, as Danielle McGuire documents in her book that I cite a lot, At the Dark End of the Street, the ritualized rape of black women in the South, often by police officers, often by bus drivers, and the resistance against those attacks by seasoned activists like Rosa Parks is really what spearheaded the civil rights movement. I don't really see that analysis stressed here in this show, but the act of fleeing Southern danger is documented in this short video on the Great Migration.
In the first half of the 20th century, 6 million African American men, women, and children left their homes in the rural South. It's known as the Great Migration. They were seeking a better life, one free of poverty and Jim Crow laws, where their humanity was not denied, their economic prospects were not limited, and their lives were not endangered. The North was a symbol of hope and opportunity. With the outbreak of World War I in Europe, Northern factories and steel mills were hiring. At first, a trickle of families came North. To New York, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Philadelphia, or Detroit. In the city, African Americans were free of the harsh racial domination of the South. But the North was no promised land. African Americans were often restricted to the most menial and dangerous jobs and faced discrimination in housing. After World War I, black soldiers returned home with high expectations that their sacrifices would be rewarded with greater fairness and opportunity. Instead, they faced fierce competition for jobs and housing. White resentment boiled over, and race riots erupted in cities across the country. The worst of the riots was in Chicago. After 13 days, over 500 people were injured and 38 were dead. 23 of them African Americans. More than 1,000 African American families were burned out of their homes. But there was no going back. By 1930, 1.3 million African Americans from the South were living above the Mason-Dixon line. When the country sank into the Great Depression, the migration slowed. But a second, larger wave of 5 million African Americans would begin to pour out of the South as World War II approached. This time, they moved north and west to cities like Alameda and Richmond in California and Portland, Oregon. For the new arrivals, the cities were strange and confusing places. African-American newspapers and organizations worked to help the newcomers get settled into their new lives. They still faced discrimination, but their children were gaining new opportunities. Northern schools weren't without problems, but here they would have the chance to learn. Life's uncertainties would continue, but their eyes were on the future. The Great Migration had transformed the lives of hardworking African Americans, and they in turn had transformed America's cities.
Of course, one place where resistance is definitely at the forefront is the hall dedicated to the civil rights movement. I try to speak to the curator and gather sound for this piece, but I'm thwarted at every turn by a pushy TV crew who is hogging up all the time and ruining my sound.
To be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the right as a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
The sound is coming from a human-sized video screen filled with those familiar images and sounds of the era. On the surrounding walls, there are artifacts, scores of photos, and lots of written information. Maybe in all the text, I am missing it, but I am not seeing the historic connection between police violence in Montgomery, Alabama, against women, the Black Panthers' defense against police brutality, and today's Black Lives Matter movement against police murders and brutality. I don't see a big reference to our resistance since the murder of Trayvon Martin at all. But perhaps, like in the section on slavery, all the content is not displayed for the press preview, which seems very odd. There is an adjoining lunch counter exhibit inspired by the 1960s student sit-ins to desegregate eating establishments and sponsored in big letters by the Rockefeller Foundation. I sit on one stool, click on a menu that includes sit-ins, freedom rides, and Black Power. And under this Black Power section, there is a section in small letters that says police brutality. It included a sort of quiz about options for being an activist. And so I started to wonder, who put this together? Who was the decider for the answers about how to best be an activist? I don't know. Was it the Rockefeller Foundation? The next section kind of combines a lot of issues around politics and sports. You'll hear some sound from Shirley Chisholm and then the sports exhibit that seems to be very much centered around ESPN. But I'm really interested in what Harry Edwards, the scholar, is talking about in terms of athlete farms, like in foreign countries, you know, other places competing with our homegrown talent for places, spots in the NBA or maybe even the NFL or whatever. And almost in a way that Dominican players compete with American talent for slots in baseball. But first we'll hear Shirley Chisholm announcing her run for the presidency of the United States.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. I stand here now without endorsement from many big-name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop. I do not intend to offer to you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate of the people of America.
for 30 minutes, put on a marvelous show.
Andy Johnson all alone. Look at this guy. Play score.
Sometimes we have more honest discussions about race, about gender, about sexuality in the world of sports than we do in any other sphere in our society.
It never ceases to amaze me how often sports takes us to a place that drives a conversation.
It's a unified statement from the Clippers players wearing their warm-up shirts inside out, so the word Clippers are not across their chest. A statement apparently made regarding the racist comments allegedly made by owner Donald Sterling.
The thing about sports is that it has given us had the three things that most African Americans have wanted: equality, acceptance, and a sense of belonging. And sometimes there are unintended consequences of us embracing and, to some degree, over-embracing sports.
Hoop Dreams is sort of the quintessential urban American dream. It was set in Chicago, but it didn't have to be. It could be in Detroit, it could be in Washington, D.C., it could be in Oakland. The kids think that's the only way out. And a whole generation of young black men, children, grew up thinking that was the only way out.
I think it was Barkley telling me once, you know, he's from Leeds, Alabama, and playing pickup basketball on the courts. And he said, people don't understand, for us, it wasn't just, oh, let's go down and get some exercise. In their mind, it was life or death. Everything hinged on it because it was their ticket out.
People would chase this dream to no end, regardless of the consequences. The hoop dream is not all bad, but it's carried a lot of people in a direction that they might have wanted to get off that train, and they couldn't, because it's also an addiction.
The only avenue of success for us, let certain people tell it, is through music, acting, or sports, not usually academics. I feel like that's just such an outdated narrative about African Americans, that all we're about is sports and not the arts or sciences or other disciplines.
Our struggle is going to be to hold on to ground that we thought we had already conquered.
Africa, we are happy.
Africa, we are happy.
NBA, we are coming.
NBA, we are coming.
Many countries have developed such an interest that the NBA, various colleges and universities and so forth have set up academies to develop players and athletes in those foreign venues. In other words, increasingly, as a result of globalization, we are offshoring athlete development. In this particular stage of the struggle, we are in danger of losing it all.
More from the museum after this brief break. This is Esther Averin from On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C., and I'm taking my tour through the new National Museum of African American History and Culture on the National Mall, and I'm to the section on culture. It's the highest floor in the building. And I don't know if the culture exhibit has a totally different designer, but perhaps because the culture curators had more to work with in terms of audio visual, the exhibit comes to life with this 360 degrees of images and sound in one room, and is followed up in the next room with Chuck Berry's Red Cadillac and the mothership from George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. There's a soundboard that allows me to mix my own version of hit songs.
Nice. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
I meet another reporter, Amir Shah, from the magazine Rolling Out, and he's live streaming and, you know, collecting material for social media and posts, and he offers this feedback about the hip-hop offerings.
Well, when it came to music, I didn't really see any true West Coast representation within the hip-hop section, but she pointed out MC Hammer and Tupac, and the thing about MC Hammer and Tupac was that they kind of superseded their own coast, where it was like Tupac was nationally known.
He was really from the East Coast.
He was Baltimore, did some time in New York, and he did some time in Oakland. So he was, his mother was all over the place. So he didn't really represent a coast. He really represented black culture more so than a coast.
Right.
MC Hammer, his music really wasn't indicative of Bay Area.
Like the Chronic and After, basically.
Dr. Dre, they represented the culture of black people in South Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And you can only get that from this music.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't. It was a time in the 90s or in the 80s where it was like hip hop was specific to a region. It was regional specific.
Right.
So the stories that you heard in Texas wasn't going to necessarily be the stories that you heard in the Bronx. It wasn't necessarily going to be the stories that you heard in Oakland. It's just necessarily going to be the story that you heard in the South Central Los Angeles
New York, right.
Or New York. So it was so specific to the black youth movement in those specific regions.
Right, and that would be important to reflect.
I said, you know, there's really no West Coast representation for your hip hop, and I'm not knocking you. This is not a thing, but I'm just like, this is what this.
Just talking to the curator.
I was talking to the curator. She's from Wisconsin. She stays in D.C. now, she was a little bit defensive, and you know, she was saying she didn't have much space, and they wouldn't give her this, and they wouldn't give her that. Like, she said, she reached out to Snoop, and she couldn't get into contact with Snoop. And I'm like, how don't you get in contact with Snoop? Snoop is everywhere.
Wrong.
I'm still processing overall, but that was just some small things, and it's like, because music is so grand within the black experience. It's kind of hard to kind of get everything within, you know, the black music can almost have a museum within itself.
So I almost missed the Visual Arts Gallery, but speak to the chief curator about the museum's permanent and changing exhibits.
My name is Jacqueline Serwer, and I'm the chief curator here at the museum, and my special area is the visual arts.
So what was the goal in terms of organizing this collection here for the visual arts?
Well, first, we wanted to make sure that our audience understands that, you know, they associate music and popular culture with the black community, but not everybody understands what a long history and what depth there is in the field of the visual arts. And so our director right from the first, Lonnie Bunch, said that he wanted to have a major art collection in the museum. And he left it up to his two art curators, my colleague Talisa Femling. And so, you know, we were encouraged to decide what kind of work we wanted, how we wanted to organize it, how it would be compatible and also enrich the stories that were being told in other galleries in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had a really, really wonderful time. And what we wanted to do above all was to find a way to encourage people to look at this work with fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't do the usual categories by chronology or by style or by medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this mixture, and we have and we've created groupings that are not traditional.
So what are your groupings?
Well, we have this one is religion and spirituality. We have African connections. We have the struggle for freedom. We have the world around us. All very non-traditional ways of organizing an exhibition. In addition, we have, and I can give you all the... and then we have a changing gallery down at the end. This is the politics of identity, where we have a lot of African Cobra pieces and Barclay Hendrix that is actually on loan, this wonderful Amy Sherald painting. She's a young artist in Baltimore.
So,
and
when you organized the politics of identity, what were some of the things that you were particularly thinking about, given that this is an African-American history and cultural museum? Do you think that there are particular ways that African-Americans view identity in a political way that other groups don't?
Well, to some extent, they've almost had to do that because they've been relegated to a special category. We're trying to talk about this as American art. Yes, these are all works by black artists, but at its foundation, this is American art. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted one of the ways we could get away from their exclusion was not to to use the categories that were the excuse for excluding them.
Right.
And so, and also this way, we've found it really interesting to mix time periods and media and subject matter. So what we've done, you know, that's the beauty of color and form in there, and we have a Bearden, and we have a Thomas, Alma Thomas, and we have Ed Clark and Mavis Pusey. These are artists, a lot of whom people are not familiar with, mm-hmm. but you know, they all work in this semi-abstract way, using color and shape mm-hmm. Magnificently. And so, because you know, if you use the usual categories, then that's a way of excluding people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have to fit particular rules and regulations, then often, especially black artists, were excluded from those categories.
And so what are some of those normal categories that we get?
Well, usually if you go to a normal art museum, they tend to organize by chronology. They tend to organize by medium. They tend to organize by style. Mm-hmm. And we thought we don't have to abide by any of those rules, and so we've gone about it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so it's the works have a relationship to each other, but we have created groupings that are non-traditional and that hopefully will allow people to look at this work with fresh eyes and not just see what is the usual expectation in an art museum setting.
So I also heard you mention that there were submissions from HBCUs?
Yes, we have several works. We have, if you want to come in to this gallery, mm-hmm. We have loans from Clark, Atlanta University, from Spelman, and from Howard. We have one, two, three are loans from HBCUs.
So the Aaron Douglas is from Howard?
That's from Howard, yes.
I think I've seen
yes.
it there.
Yeah. Well, it's an iconic Aaron Douglas. It's so wonderful. Uh-huh. Somebody was just telling me that her friend got a tattoo with this image of Aaron Douglas.
And this is
Tanner. Okay. And this is from Clark Atlanta University.
Okay.
Clark has had a great art collection for many, many decades. In the middle of the century, they set up, they had a kind of yearly competition. And from, you know, they gave prizes to one or two pieces that then became part of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and we're very indebted to them because if it weren't for those museums at the HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, we wouldn't have a lot of this work.
Okay.
Because the museums were not collecting it.
Okay.
So we're very grateful. That's ours. That's a Duncanson, the Garden of Eden, Charles White in here. That's ours. Mm-hmm. So, but these one, two, three are on loans from the HBCUs.
I've seen this one before.
Move on up a little higher. Charles White is very successful, credible artist and this is this was a famous spiritual that was one of the anthems of the civil rights movement,
uh-huh.
and so he has this image that talks about uplift and struggle and perseverance and survival and
mm-hmm.
And of course he's one of the great draftsmen of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's the name comes from a gospel song by William Herbert Brewster, very much one of the anthems of this rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
So art is at the top level of the museum, perhaps echoing the idea that art is the
you know, the highest of human achievement. As much as I enjoy the liveliness of it, I fear that I've come to all this fun too quickly without addressing in the same visceral fashion the terror we have overcome and that we are still facing on the streets even today, from police, from overseas and our throughout the diaspora. And still, security has to shoo me and other journalists out of the building after being there for several hours, like all day.
The museum is now closed, and I need everyone to go downstairs to catch the elevator for me.
Oh,
The new museum tells a story, and that is what history is. This is my journey through the museum, where a free 3-day Freedom Sounds Festival begins Friday, September 23rd, when I'm airing this. And that festival will include Michelle Indigachelo, Anjali Kijo, Living Color, Public Enemy, and The Roots, and many other artists. The grand opening and dedication ceremony is Saturday, September 24th. So every one of us, like I said at the top of our journey, every one of us walking into the new bronze edifice on the National Mall, that is the National Museum of African American History and Culture, will have our own unique experience, depending on what perspective, knowledge, and memory we are bringing with us. Right now, I resist physical and economic violence against Black people. I have this ever-evolving recognition of horrors and terror that African Americans, particularly women, have lived with and continue to live with, and that we resist. This is where I am still as I complete my journey that I have just shared with you. Thank you for taking the journey with me. That will do it for us on the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Avaram. Thanks to my engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you so much again for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows, including our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On The Ground Show. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
Oh, the thrill is gone. I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you on one of these days.